And welcome back to Projector Room, where I'm very, very happy that summer has come back and it's so bloody hot again. But let's not moan, because we're here to talk about exciting and interesting things in film, cinema and TV, aren't we, Gareth?
Yes, it would be a nice change of pace if you were to moan about the summer. So maybe next year.
Yes, I'm sure it will come far too quickly around again for me. GarethMiles.com is Gareth's website, and I'm at TedSalmon.com. And our website for this podcast is projectorroom.co.uk. And you'll find links to all that stuff that we're going to talk about this evening in this blazing heat. I mean, this evening on our website, as well as in your podcatcher. First up is a bit of feedback from the group, or contribution from the group in this case, and it's Chad Dixon on The End of Oak Street, which we saw in Coming Soon in the group. And you, Gareth, I think you were a bit kind of dubious about, and I was more enthusiastic. But this science fiction adventure opens in 1982 suburban Michigan, says Chad, where a neighborhood summer street party hides growing friction in the Platt household. Dad Greg, played by Ewan McGregor, is working excessive hours, leaving mum Denise and Hathaway frustrated, while their two kids, Audrey and Brian, worry about where the marriage is heading. However, domestic drama pales into insignificance the following night when a violent storm hits. By the morning, the power is cut, the temperature has spiked, and the family dog is missing. As the parents drive off to search for the dog, the true nightmare unfolds. The entire street has somehow teleported back to the, oh dear, what's that? How do you pronounce that word? Cretaceous. Cretaceous period. Chad will tell me off for not having practiced that. As prehistoric beasties invade the suburbs, the family must adapt quickly. Seeing well-rendered dinosaurs causing total chaos in 1980s suburbia is immensely entertaining, says Chad, and the heartwarming bond between the two kids keeps the story grounded when they get separated from their parents. At a brisk 1 hour 40 minutes, it's a quirky ride too. Ewan McGregor, however, feels miscast, says Chad. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why an American lead wasn't chosen instead. But Anne Hathaway completely carries the film anyway, making all the tough decisions in the end. While plenty of humans meet their demise, it's not visually gory, therefore making it solid family viewing. Overall, it's great cinema entertainment. And just so you know, J.J. Abrams is already eyeing up another money-spinning franchise. Right. Thank you, Chad. So what do you think, Gareth? Is that, are your fears sounded?
Well, possibly, yes. I'm still kind of looking forward to this. I was really actually hoping that this was going to be some sort of Cloverfield cash-in. They had gone to extra lengths to say this is not part of the Cloverfield universe. And I thought, you know, maybe at the last minute they might go, let's just do something. So I'm hoping that, or I had hoped that there would be something there. But, you know, Ewan McGregor, I think, is always a decent lead. And I'm a bit perturbed by Chad's comments about how he was miscast. But I'll give it a go whenever it arrives. It's something that I think the whole family can enjoy. And hopefully it's much better than that bloody Disclosure Day thing we saw recently.
Fair enough. Okay, thanks a lot, Chad. And some thoughts now from Flop of the Fortnight, he says, scrolling through his notes. you chucked in something that I watched years ago, so I can comment here.
All right, okay. Well, to tell the truth, I watched the original movie in the series just a couple of weeks ago, but I didn't mention it on the broadcast because I don't really have any feelings other than it's an agreeable comedy. Meet the Parents is quite funny. It does most things right. And it's a fairly enjoyable time. I was on board with it, and I enjoyed seeing Robert De Niro having that big switch over to comedy. And it was one of the first big comedies that he'd done. So, I suppose he'd done Midnight Run and We're No Angels, but We're No Angels is a terrible film and not very funny. So Meet the Parents was, you know, I love it whenever an actor goes outside of their comfort zone. And De Niro did it well and absolutely showed that he was a comedy mastermind. So the sequel was ruled out because Meet the Parents was such a huge hit. And Jesus Christ, is this the worst film ever made? I mean, anything that is remotely funny in this film is a carryover from the previous film. Nothing introduced in this film is funny at all. It's cringeworthy the whole way through. I actually feel sorry for Robert De Niro because of the things he has to do and say in this. He looks almost embarrassed, or he can't quite compute how this sort of affair is successful. Ben Stiller, he's there and he supports the movie. Dustin Hoffman, oh my goodness, what an utterly outrageous character that does not have any symbolism of reality at all. That person, that character, is totally detached from reality in every single way, as is Barbra Streisand's character. Barbra Streisand's character and Terry Polo, who plays Ben Stiller's soon-to-be wife, and who was the other? Blythe Danner. They are so relegated because they're women to the side, and it's just, yep, here's the men being daft and silly for the entire runtime. It was maddening the whole way through. It was like, can we have some form of input from the female characters in this film, or are we just ignoring them entirely? And they do. They do give them the odd line here and there. Barbra Streisand gets the odd funny line, but other than that, no. No, they are completely relegated and might as well not be in the film. It was so painful to get through this. The baby storyline, don't start me on that bloody child in the film. It was just cringe. Oh, I wanted to punch whoever decided to add that child into this film. And the fact that they went on to make another film after that, and there is another one in the pipeline. So we're going to have four Meet the Whatever films. I want to meet the writer of Meet the Fockers and just give them a good hiding, because there is nothing in this film that is remotely funny. And Owen Wilson shows up for no reason at all. It was a cringeworthy cameo. And I couldn't wait until this was over. One of the hardest things about this film, one of the most difficult things to get through with this film, is 155 minutes. Or no, 1 hour 55. That's the running time, where there's completely devoid of jokes. This thing is utter garbage. I hated it from end to end. Do you agree?
Oh, well, first of all, I would say that I didn't know this was part of anything, and I've only seen Meet the Fockers. I've not seen Meet the Parents or whatever other things you've got. I was dragged along to the cinema by someone in 2004, I think, or 2005, to watch Meet the Fockers. And I have to say that I haven't seen it since then. So we're talking about 22 years later. And I have to say that when we came out of the cinema, we were, of course, it's a crappy American comedy, but we were thinking it was funny. The people I was with, we thought it was okay. And yes, it's daft and stupid and everyone, all of the things that you just said. But through that, we were just amused by the whole thing. And it was just silly and daft, but funny. So maybe that's the approach that, you know, that the audience in America that they're going for is people like me in this particular instance, who are going to watch it with a group of people and can egg each other on about how that it's actually not bad, but actually if you approach it in the right way, it can be funny. But I do agree with you that the whole there was so many things in it that are just stupid and daft and And yes, the characters are really, really annoying and stupid, but that's what they've been written to be like that, haven't they?
Well, yes, they have, but I'm amazed. No, you must hit the nail on the head there because you were with other people, so you were able to laugh along in a group, as opposed to, because it is so heavily reliant on the previous film for most of its laughs, the most of the laughs that actually work. And Jay Roach is such a competent director. I'm having a quick look to see who wrote it, and Jim Herzfeld, who wrote the original, and oh, not much else. Seems to have given up the ghost after this. Potentially, maybe he just didn't like his own film and decided, no, that's it, I'm off. But yeah, it must be a group of people thing. And Ray Santiago, who I think is great from Ash versus Evil Dead, he plays this Mexican youngster who might possibly be Ben Stiller's Mexican child. And oh, it was just painful. I guess because nobody really knew who he was at the time, it doesn't look like they've just put stupid bits of hair on Ray Santiago to make him look like Ben Stiller and made him, pokey out ears and things like that. And now we know what he looks like properly. It's like, whoa. And then Tim Blake Nelson, who plays one of the officer at the end, who pulls Robert De Niro and Ben Stiller over. He is such a talent, such a wonderful comedic and dramatic actor. And to see him reduced to playing this fairly early role in his filmography, but he was just untapped. Oh, it was a painfully difficult role for him to or for anyone to have to endure seeing him in. Oh, there is nothing about this film I can recommend whatsoever, and I dread the fact that we're two films into the franchise, and there's another two that I have to go before I'm done, because this was worse than Beneath the Planet of the Apes, absolutely worse.
Oh dear. Fair enough. So yeah, different views on that. But like I say, 22 years ago, I was much younger for one thing, and I was with a group of people, and as I say, maybe groups of people just egg each other along, and kind of you get a better result from it. Anyway, fair enough. I'm going to put a 2026 film in to Flop of the Fortnight, which is called The Devil's Mouth, which is an Amazon Prime film, creature feature, which is. Features five incredibly annoying American college graduate kind of teenagers and they go off to have an adventure in, where is it, in Thailand, I think it's in Thailand, and they ignore the warnings about flooded subterranean cave networks and blah blah blah. And then eventually they get themselves down there and they get stuck, of course, and then they this massive bull shark turns up, and then the rest of the film is about them trying to escape from this shark as the shark picks them off one by one. And you can imagine how it goes. The first, as I always say with these types of films, the first half an hour, honestly, I promise you do not need to watch. It's just bikini-clad people, women, muscular, teenage boys, and it's just like you don't need to know anything about the build-up to this at all. So start 35 minutes in if you're going to watch this. But I wouldn't
But what
suggest you
about the
watch it.
bikini-clad women?
Well, as I say, if you want to see that, then don't start 35 minutes in. But the point is that you, in order
So only
to.
watch the first 35 minutes. Gotcha.
Yes. And the point is that you can get the takeaways from this film by just not seeing the first half hour. Anyway, so then we get into the kind of the shark hunting them. To be honest, The real star of the show is this kind of setting where they're in these caves, which actually has been done really well. Apparently, it was all filmed in a big tank, as they do. But the shark is just pathetic and just really badly CGI shark. And there's nothing new here at all. That you've seen it all before. This group of girls, one of the girls is incredibly annoying, more annoying than the rest of them. And she is just like the token coward, kind of, and it's been, she's again, like you were saying about Meet the Fockers, she's been written this role and she's doing it. It's not her fault. It's the writers that have made her so stupidly annoying. Anyway, so you can imagine what the outcome is, and you can imagine who survives or who doesn't survive or how many survive. I bet you can guess how many survives and which gender they are. Or it is.
One final girl.
Exactly. But we didn't give away that spoiler, did we?
Well, it was a guess, so it's not a spoiler.
Yeah. Right, anyway, there you go. So... The Devil's Mouth, which is on Amazon, and I wouldn't bother. But if you do, then if you want to see bikinis, then miss out the everything from 35 minutes in. All right. If you don't want to see bikinis, vice versa. Let's move. Should we move to fandom? Have fandom focus. Have you actually had a look at this Devil's Mouth thing? Did we do it in Coming Soon?
I'm actually just going through Google Images at the moment. I've typed in the Devil's Mouth bikini, and
yes, right.
I'm doing the poster for the podcast, Ted.
Yes, well done. Yes, well done. Don't put the shark in it. Put the bikinis in it. You're right. Okay. Fandom focus. My turn to choose something that I'm a fan of this week, this time, and I'm going to choose World War II films and TV shows. And the reason that I picked up on this was because I happen to have been watching Hello, Hello again, which I do now and again, and I'm very tempted to watch the whole thing from start to finish every couple of years or something, because it is just so funny and so well done, and it's so... interesting from a World War II perspective. And in that whole mix of TV shows, I do similar things with Dad's Army. Dad's Army is something I just go back to. It's a really good period piece because it basically doesn't date. Because it is set in that time, it just doesn't go away. It's been done in such a way that it just doesn't date, and the characters in it are all really rich and they've got their own quirks and they've all been really well written, as have those in Hello, Hello. As we know, Hello, Hello is more of a kind of pantomime almost, but again, it's quite well written in a kind of Heidi High type way. I really enjoy both of those shows. I also dip in and out of It Ain't Half Hot Mum, which is one that a lot of people miss on the kind of Second World War thing. If you're looking at comedy escapes from the war stuff, some really good. In a minute, maybe you can add some World War II TV shows to the list. But in terms of films, the ones that I go back to always are things like The Great Escape, the classics, I love the Dam Busters, The Eagle Has Landed, to watch Jenny Agutter, the Where Eagles Dare, Von Ryan's Express, and then we've got the more modern ones, which are, you know, Schindler's List and Downfall and Valkyrie, and even Inglourious Basterds, the Tarantino thing as well. So they just seem to continue to make World War II films. They don't stop. But we did go through that period in the 60s when they were making a lot of them, the ones that I just mentioned. And I can easily just go back to them time and time again and get more from them. I know we've talked about this on the show before, and Alan was a huge fan of these kind of glut of World War II films, as we all are, I think. I would just like to say that I am a fan. It's my fandom focus. Pretty much anything to do with World War II. I'm not sure if it's partly to do with the fact of my age. So my parents that dragged me up, they obviously were alive during the Second World War, so that had an influence on what was talked about in our house and what we would watch on the television when it came along. The Dam Busters on Saturday afternoon if there was no wrestling and whatever. And so you just get into this culture of Second World War stuff because possibly of my age and their ages and their cultural background and history. So that was it. What can you add to that?
Oh, I'm trying to think of which direction to take it. Obviously, talking about World War II comedies and things like that is I think Bilko might be one that you could throw in there as well, or Phil Silver's show if you like it that way, or McKeel's Navy, two very popular American-based World War II comedies there that I do think are worth a mention because they were kind of cult classics in a way, and almost like the American versions of Dad's Army, I suppose. Band of Brothers is one that you should really check out. That's a really great limited TV
What
series.
brothers?
Band of Brothers.
Oh, Band of Brothers, right, okay.
Yeah, back from, I think it was about 2001 that came
Yeah,
out.
yeah.
And then there was The Pacific as well, which is kind of a follow-up series, not a sequel, but a follow-up. And they did one quite recently with our mate Anthony Boyle. About the Air Force, I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but there was one. Whenever, well, Hogan's Heroes as well. That's another one that
Oh,
the
yeah.
Americans did quite well. But I always think that one film that gets left out of sort of classic war movies is Das Boot, and
Yes, yeah.
that was absolutely amazing. I love it. And I got the German Blu-ray of it, which has the longer version than the one you get standard. I can't remember the running time, but there was a mini
Six
series of it as well,
hours.
something like that. Yeah, and then there's Catch 22 and Cold It's and a bunch of those. Alan always went on about The Man in the High Castle, which is an alternative
Oh, yeah.
World War II storyline, and I quite like that as well. And I picked up Holocaust quite recently with Meryl Streep, which is a mini series. I haven't got to it yet, but just have a quick look down my Plex queue, and it's there. So yeah, there's loads of them, and I
Oh,
think it's
yeah. I forgot about Holocaust. I've seen that. Yeah.
yeah. It was quite hard to get for a while because I was trying to track it down, but eventually got it, and I'll get to that too.
I seem to remember it's well worth watching. I seem to remember it's very, very well done. Holocaust, yeah. But there's tons of them. You start digging around. You don't even need to dig around, and they don't seem to get fed up with making them either. We recently had 1917 as well, didn't we? And we were talking about that on the show right up to now. We were talking about also that German art house one, which I now can't remember off the top of my head. Just recently, it's just recently been made. The point is, I think, is they
Oh, the
don't.
one with Mark Ruffalo, Every Breath You Take or something, or All the Breath in the World, or we watched it.
Did we?
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking about that one, but
Okay.
anyway, the point I'm making really is that they just don't seem to get fed up with making them, and we don't seem to get fed up, or at least people of my age, and it would appear your age as well, don't get fed up watching them. So they keep coming, which is great. I like it.
Well, without affecting the YouTube algorithm, but the German army back then, with an N to start it, they're generally a really easy villain for anyone to fight against. It's just, ghosts, zombies, and they tend to really kind of pull. You can do anything and get away with it. You can portray them any way you want and do anything nasty to them, without, if you were to do that against the Spanish or the British, as the Americans used to do in a lot of movies, then people take offense. So if you do it against zombies and the other one I said, ghosts, then you can do anything you like.
Yeah, and we saw there was a raft of those ones based in Russia. What were they called? We were talking
dead
about.
Dead snow.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Nazi zombies.
Oh, I just... gruesome and violent films that we went through, or at least I went through a kind of spell of watching about, I don't know, 6 months ago, which were quite fun and funny, particularly when the zombies were involved.
Yeah.
Anyway, there you go. That's my fandom focus. And World War II films and TV shows, which I keep going back to. Oh yeah, Blackadder. Forgot about that.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Well, right, Blackadder goes forth. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, the First World War. The first Blackadder goes forth was the First World War. So actually, there wasn't a Second World War one, was there? Forget I said that. Ignore me.
Right. Good point.
Private screening. The Last House was the film which... Did I choose that or did you? I can't remember now.
You chose them both, yeah. You gave me the option.
Both. So we had The Last House, which was the film, and we had the Alley Cats, which is the Ricky Gervais comedy, which we spoke about both of these in Coming Soon. So would you like to go first on either of these?
Well, I can go really quickly on The Last House because to be completely honest about it, I watched it before we recorded the last show. So it's not that fresh in my memory. And there's no damn way I'm going back to rewatch it because I was not entirely enthusiastic about it. It's not bad, but it's still not great either. It was a really good premise, really interesting in that kind of A Quiet Place kind of way. And I felt the two shared... They could have even been the same universe. They were pretty close, but it started to grate and it started to get annoying. And it felt like by the time you got to the climax, that you'd run a mile and then you got to the climax and there was no real finishing line. It was a wee bit of a fairly damp squib whenever it arrived, and I think the more interesting side of the tale is what happens after the climax. And it's one of those films that is so, so thirsty to get rid of this story and just move on and get the end credits going that you see maybe 30 to 45 seconds of the world after the big showdown has happened. And it's like, yep, here we go. And everything's grand. The end. It's like, oh, flipping heck, you know, you've just done all the work to get to that point and you don't even get that plane is really close. Hmm.
You don't even get some sort of enjoyable epilogue where you see the family sort of starting a new life or something like that. And I've got a funny feeling this isn't even going to have a sequel or anything. It reminded me of COVID in many ways. It was those, you know, you were having to self-isolate inside this house and they were stuck there for a ridiculous amount of time. And then whenever they got out, they didn't get to jump around in the parks and things like that and enjoy their lives. It just was like, let's be done with this and move on. So I wasn't a big thing into this. I like the cast. The cast were pretty good. I thought the casting of the kids as they got older was exceptional because I had to remind myself after a while, oh, flip, that child's like 16 now as opposed to 10 whenever we last saw them. And it didn't dawn on me at all because they were so well done. It was the actors passed over perfectly. So, you know, usually that sort of takes you out of the room or whatever, and you see, oh, who is this now? Oh, right, it's that child grown older. No, I didn't get that at all. It was excellent from that point of view. So there you go. There's a point. I'll give it a point for that. Wagner was good in the lead. There's a point. The chimney was good. The way they caught stuff was preposterous, so it'll lose 5 points for that. You can carry on for a while.
I've got
I got the impression that I thought that you would see something differently in it. And what I think I saw in it was the whole survival thing. And that was the interesting bit of the film, was about how they did it, and not the ridiculous premise of the film in the first place, being trapped, everyone's trapped in their houses for no apparent sci-fi type reason. Just because some rain had kind of trapped them in, you know, there's lots of stupid premise about it. But if you take it that these people are stuck in this house and we stay with them as they try to work out how to survive when the food runs out, the electricity runs out, the everything runs out, and the water runs out, and they've got to find ways of surviving. And the takeaway for me was much, much more about that part of the film. The end of it, I do agree with you, was a bit disappointing, but then it's different. It's fine. Some films don't have a Hollywood ending, and they don't have a bow tied around it. So I was okay with the ending, but I think that the strength of the film was definitely the middle bit, staying with the characters, getting to know them, seeing the interaction between the characters, and yes, the 5-year jump between the two younger actors going and two newer actors coming in was done really well. I agree with you, and it was fine. I think that one of the notes I made was that the end, towards the end of it, it gets a bit Disney, I said, and I can't really say any more than that about it without giving away spoilers, but it was okay. The interesting bit was definitely, though, in the house, stuck there, surviving, working out ways of doing it, even though you say the chimney one was a daft one, okay, but there were lots of other ways in which they worked out how to survive and get on with each other. And it was, to me, it was a character study almost of that part of the film. So I'm going to score it higher than you, and I'm going to give it a 10 out of 15.
10 out of 15? So that's higher than me, is it?
Sorry, I saw your score in the the recording notes, and I forgot to pretend not to have seen it.
Ah, right, okay. Well, I'm just going to mess with you because I'm going to change it. 5 out of 15.
Oh, dear. You really didn't like it, yeah.
Yeah, I was incredibly let down. I felt it really sunk itself, and it's not a great film. Really isn't. And I don't think it does very much to entice people to ever watch it again, which is perfect for Netflix.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think that the actors were good, though. As you say, the bloke from Narcos was good. And Greta Lee, who was in Past Lives, I remember. I reviewed that. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, because she did a really good turn in that film as well. And all four of the kids, I thought, did good roles as well. So,
yeah.
Anyway, 15 gives it half marks, obviously. And we'll move on to Alley Cats, the trials and tribulations of a group of British cats from all walks of society who seek companionship while ruminating on everyday life. So this is Ricky Gervais getting together his usual bunch of team members. Think After Life and The Office and Derek and whatever else he's done. And he's got all these people together. Diane Morgan's in there and Kerry Godleyman. And others. It's very much like watching an Afterlife team. I think the point about it is quite funny. I really appreciate Gervais's humour. I think the overuse of the word cunt is, I do think that is, he seems to like doing that. On his stand-up sets, he does it an awful lot as well. And I've got no problem with the word at all. It's fine. And it doesn't offend me. It's just that it was done in every sentence from every one of the cats. So these animated cats are just basically playing the actors. You know, if the actors could have just sat around a studio or a house and just said these things to each other. I mean, there are some cat puns thrown in, fair enough. But you've got to be okay with his kind of sledgehammer wit as well, and his delivery, and as I say, the language and his life view. But I'm okay with that, and I like what he does, and I'm all right. I found it to be quite good fun. It was fairly well written, but it felt also sometimes a bit lazy in terms of the storylines. They're really short, incidentally, if people don't know. They're 15 minutes each. So you've got 6 episodes and they're only 15 minutes each. So it's really easy to just race through it and watch it all. I did catch myself laughing out loud a lot of the time at it. The neighbours must have thought I was mad. But yeah, I think it was a little bit too short. So I'm going to mark it down to 13 out of 15. Otherwise, it would have got 14 because of the language thing I was talking about, taking a point away, I think, overusing the term as it did. But yeah, cartoon cats, think Aristocats, cats kind of hanging about, just talking to each other and doing stuff and talking about the world and the universe and their role in it, and you know, the usual Gervais stuff, really reflective and talking about life. And if you approach it with that kind of the thing, I think it's all right. It's funny enough and it worked well for me, but I can also understand if you weren't a Gervais fan how it could be. You could sit there thinking, this is ridiculous, how stupid is this? So which way did you go?
Well, I found it quite difficult to get through, to be honest. I don't think this knew exactly what it wanted to be. And half of what you talk about is exactly it, in the fact that it is it's quite happy to have a hard edge to it, where it'll use a huge amount of profanity, whilst also being quite dark in its comedy, yet there is a heart, and it felt like this should either be one or the other. It should either be you know, a kind of a family comedy with that heart, or something like a late night Channel 4 comedy show that doesn't have to cater to kids. You know, no one who watches this is going to come away a better person. Especially whenever they've injected this heart into it, because they want you to, you know, they hug and things like that at the end, and they do care about each other. It's like, why have you put that in? That's completely unnecessary. You know, you're not coming to this to watch something like The Simpsons that is going to be, you know, it's going to, you know, happily entertain the whole family, because it's got the C word in it a lot. So it seems like it's targeted for anarchic teens and jaded older people who want something kind of nasty, alternative comedy. But it's not alternative comedy. It's very standard comedy, but with a large amount of profanity. And I it just didn't mix with me, and I felt as the first episode came to an end, and what is it, the kitten is having trouble sleeping, and Gervais's cat takes pity and cuddles the cat to sleep. It's like, no, that's not what I've come here for. I've come here for Ricky Gervais's proper satire on life, his understanding of cats and how they are pricks, absolute self-centered pricks. But instead he's decided, no, we need to turn this into a family with family values and looking out for each other, and they need to gang together to take on this world, no matter what level of the status quo you're at. If you're living in the big fancy house, you need to know, you know, it's not class war. We're all in this together. And yeah, that's fine, but there's a time and a place for that. This is a bad, nasty comedy that you want to see nasty things happen. And I'm trying to think of some examples of where that does happen. And I'm coming up blank, to be honest, but I can think of, you know, shows where they, at the last moment, you think there's going to be some sort of resolution, but there isn't. And it's just, they just have a laugh and make fun of each other because they're savage. And I couldn't get into it just because it let me down. It really, really did. It is more like Afterlife, where he tries to have a heart and it doesn't need it. It really doesn't need it. That's not what I want from this.
Okay. What are you going to score it then? 0.
No, I wouldn't go that low because the opening of the episodes is actually kind of funny whenever the cats are being mean and nasty. And I'll give it 3. No, 4.
Oh, that's a shame. So that gives it, I'm going to give it 13, as I said, but so that gives it a total of 17, which puts it, what did we just give the other one? 15. It's a bit higher than that then. So 17.
But that's because you loved it.
Yeah, I suppose so. I wouldn't say I loved either of these two things, but I obviously thought more about more of both of them than you did. But 17 and 16 for those two things are kind of a third of the way up the table in the general vicinity of the Night Clerk, and I Think We're Alone Now, and The War Below, and Sharper, and Beef. I don't remember what Beef is. What's Beef?
It was a Netflix TV show with your man from The Walking Dead and... Oh, Beef. Glenn, was it from The Walking Dead? I can't
remember. Anyway, it's about two-thirds of the way down our table. So, we did 2 that time, which we won't do next time, because it's taken up far too much time of our show. And I am going to hand over to you to tell us what we are going to do next time.
Well, that'll be a straight-up British comedy that's doing the rounds of the cinemas and the TVs now. It stars Joan O'Davis, James Buckley, Martin Clunes, Mark Addy, Gabriella Wilde, and Luke Treadaway. It's directed by Nick Moorcroft, and it's called Mother's Pride. It's a pubby-type comedy, and it's got Martin Clunes in it, so I'm all over it.
Which we did in Coming Soon, didn't we?
I think we did, yeah.
I think we did, yeah.
When I figure this is the kind of thing that you would like, a pub-based comedy.
Yeah, maybe. When I looked at the trailer, I thought to myself, yeah, we've watched this before. I think it was in Coming Soon. So, yeah. And I do like some of the cast members. You're absolutely right. So there you go. Right. Now we're on to themed treats. And it was my turn to pick a themed treat. And I was going to pick a film of two halves. So there are obvious kind of examples of this. Like I said last show, From Dusk Till Dawn springs to mind quite heavily.
I wonder and, where that is. You big curve.
Because in From Dusk Till Dawn, it really is a film of two halves. The whole thing of getting to the Mexican temple bar.
What's it called again?
The nipple twister.
Titty
twister. Something like that. And then suddenly it completely changes into this completely bonkers horror kind of thriller film. And so that was a good example of one that I was talking about. And also the other example I gave was what's that other one called? The war one where they where they go
Full Metal Jacket.
So the first half of it is all the training and everything, and the whole of the second half is when they're out there in combat. And so that was my two examples. Let me hear from you first as to what you picked as examples of a film of two halves.
Well, I think the easiest and best example of this is Jaws. The first half of the film, ooh, there's a shark out there. The second half of the film, let's go get the shark. That's it. Dead simple. Two films in one. No sequel, no follow-up. Well, there was a sequel, but no need for a sequel here. Just no follow-ups or anything like that required. Go out, do the job. And, you know, it's an exceptional film, and it benefits from the two-act, or basically, yeah, it's a two-act structure. One that I have always thought of, but I don't see too many people mentioning it as being tilted this way, is Titanic, where the first half of the film is a dreary romance with Leo and Kate, not Capshaw, Winslet. You know, romping around the ship. And then the second half is whenever it gets really interesting. And the ship, it sinks. I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but it does. It goes down, and Leo and Kate romp around the ship whilst it's going down and try to save themselves. And Celine Dion sings a wee song. Isn't that Celine Dion? Or is it Sinead? No. I can't remember. It's some singer sings a song, and Billy Zane runs around with a gun, being all mad. And that it's greatly more entertaining. And I think that's why the film is such a success, because dare I be stereotypical about this, but the wife will love the first half and the husband will love the second half. Yeah. And Bill Paxton's there because he's just awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm with you on both of those. I haven't seen Titanic since day one when it came out, but what I remember of it is, you're quite right, all the interesting bits are in the second half.
Well, like, but then, 1914.
I'm a bloke. So, no, 1915, wasn't it? 19, April the 15th, 19... No, I can't remember now.
No, I think it was 1914.
Was it 14? It was, anyway, Jaws, definitely. Do you know, until you put that in here, I'd not really thought about Jaws as an example of a film of two halves, but yeah, I guess you're right. A large part of the second half of it is them out on the boat and finding the resolution. I'm not sure at what point in the runtime it goes. Do you know at what point in the runtime it goes to that phase of going out on the boat? How much of the film is on that?
I don't know. I didn't think you'd be testing me on this. hold on a second. I'll go put the Blu-ray on.
In my mind, it feels like it's probably about the last third of the film.
It's the last half.
Do you reckon it's a half? Maybe,
well, what exactly? When do they find the titty twister? When does it turn? Which frame?
That's halfway through. Yes, definitely.
Exactly. Bang on.
Yes, definitely.
Right. I'll have to check with Robert Rodriguez. Hold on. You babble on while I ring him.
Parasite is one that I kind of probably shouldn't mention for anyone that's not seen it, because the whole point of it, spoiler alert, is the second half and how it turns, and you think that you're in on this level with the story of Parasite, which is the very interesting film by Bong Joon-ho, which we've talked about loads on this show, and it's a really, really good thriller. But the first half of it, and I don't know if it's exactly 50% in before the twist and the turn, then I'm going to say no more about that, because if you haven't seen it yet, then do. But yes, close your ears to what I'm saying. But the one I wanted to highlight was one of these films where it actually does turn into two halves. This is a film, an art house film from 2002, which I think I spoke about on the show before. And it stars Audrey Audrey Tautou. The actress that was in Amelie. And she This is a film.
Oh, yes. I know her now. Yes, Emily. Yeah, got you. Sorry, go on.
Yeah. This is a film which actually does turn into two halves, because the first half of the film gets repeated in the second half, a bit like that Sliding Doors film, which was doing the rounds some years ago. So the basic story is that, she plays this art student in Paris who falls in love with this married doctor. We follow her in the first half of the film, and we see her trying to get him to leave his wife, and it turns out that his wife is pregnant. That's an aside. And tries to set up opportunities for them to be together and all the rest of it. Then we get to halfway through the film. So the first half of it is this kind of this chase by Amelie, Audrey, to get this doctor. And then right in the middle of the film, it totally starts again. And the whole story is shown again from the perspective of the shift, which I won't tell you what happens and what it is about, but it's the timeline from the doctor's point of view. And it turns out that, no, I'm not going to tell, I'm not going to give you the, in order to say what's going on here, I'd have to give away a really bad spoiler. So I'm not going to do it, but you need to be aware that it's a really nice film. It's well done. It's brilliantly acted by everyone in the show. And it does definitely do this switch around thing where the whole film is repeated in the second half, exactly as it was, but from a different view. It's a nice puzzling film as well. Keeps you on your toes, and you need to watch very carefully, a bit like watching The Sixth Sense or something. While you're watching the first half of the film, you need to watch it very closely. Background stuff, and a bit like the Three Colors trilogy. There's stuff going on in the background, behind people and around people. And then when you watch it again, when you watch the second half, you forget all that stuff's gone on in the background, and it just makes the total most of this split film. And I've had when I posed the theme of a film of two halves, I completely forgot about that one. But it was, yeah, it fits the bill beautifully. And I'm not sure how many other films, perhaps you know, are out there that that do that thing. So half of the film is the second half is a repeat of the first half, but from some other perspective. Can you think of any others? Oh, there you are. Caught you on the hop again.
Not really, no.
Fair enough. Perhaps it's unique.
Yeah. Whenever you're saying about, you know, it starts again, there's loads of those, you know, like Groundhog Day and things like that, but actually just where the film retells the same story over again. There is one in the back of my mind, but I'm not thinking very well tonight, so I'm slow.
Very sad for you. By the way, talking about this evening, I've just turned my air conditioning off and it's too hot again now, so I'm going to turn it back on. Hopefully you can't hear that, you lovely people who have made it so far into this podcast. Right, okay. Any other examples of film of two halves, or are we moving on to your choice for the next one?
We'll move on to my choice for the next one.
Go then. What is it?
Well, I'm kind of rethinking this now that I'm reading it myself, because there aren't too many to choose from. So I'm thinking about maybe using a scene that is exceptionally long, because I was thinking of films in one shot, or films that pretend to be one shot, films that are kind of filmed in real time, use cheeky cutaways and things like that to be able to get around. A perfect example is Rope has a number of different cuts, but there has to be a number of different cuts in it, because at the time they could only store 13 minutes worth of film in the camera. I think it's 13 minutes, something like that. So they had to have cheeky cuts here and there so that they could reload the film into the camera. So either a film that is all in one, or an exceptionally long take that maybe makes up a large portion of the film. And I'm thinking, you know, Goodfellas, you know, it's got a really big But it, I thought it's only like 3 minutes long or something like that.
I can only think of one film where the whole film is in one shot from start to finish. I'll bring that to the show. But it's good that it's been opened up to scenes as well, so that'll make it broader.
Yeah, we can maybe do one of it either, because I can think of one film as well, and then an exceptionally long shot.
Yeah, okay. All right, okay, that can be the theme, and you can work out how to word it in the process. Right, the main feature is next, and I want to talk about The Corpse of Anna Fritz, which is a 2015 film, a Spanish indie thriller, and it's set in a hospital morgue, and it follows an orderly on a late shift whose mates come along who are high on drugs and talk him into sneaking a peek at the newly arrived body of the famous famous beautiful actress. So the setup is that there's this body of this actress laying on the slab, and him and his mates, because she is so incredibly famous, nobody's supposed to know that she's there except the staff at the hospital. But word gets out, and they basically want to go and look at her. And when they start to look at her, they start to decide to, because she's got nothing on, obviously, they start to be a bit disrespectful with her. And then they start to get very disrespectful with her body. So let's say no more. And then right in the middle of the film, and I'm not sure if it's 50%, but right in the middle of the film, the whole thing completely twists and upends itself. Something happens in the film which I'm not going to tell you, but it turns everything completely on its head, and it turns it into a real high pressure anxiety driven thriller. And the second half of the film is really interesting in that respect. It's really, really low budget, I think, and it's all done in one set, and there's hardly any outside at all. It's all inside. I'm going to say no more about it, because it's really grim, it's absorbing, and it's, because it's about a dead body, it's all fairly kind of dark and you know, macabre fun, I was going to say.
Not Weekend at Bernie's, then.
No, exactly. And the actors are good. There's four of them. So there's the girl on the slab, who is played by Alba Rivas. I've never heard of any of the actors. And then there's the three blokes that are doing what they're doing. That's about it, really. And they do a decent enough job. It's a really nice little thriller. It's a really tight, not even 90 minutes. 76 minutes, I said, didn't I? Yeah. And it's just worth a look. It's really good. Enjoyed
it. Subtitled or dubbed?
I saw it with subtitles.
All right.
But you can take your choice. Right, you've only got one, so I'll do my second one first. The Unholy Trinity, which you probably would like. It's a Western. 1870s Montana, directed by Richard Gray. It follows young Henry Broadway, who arrives in a frontier town aiming to avenge his executed father by killing the sheriff, only to find that the target is already dead, leaving him caught between a complex web of town secrets and missing gold. So in the middle of this, you've got the new sheriff, played by Pierce Brosnan, which is why I think you'll probably know it. And also there's Samuel L. Jackson is in there as this kind of charismatic, ruthless, piss-taking, everyone around him, smart mouth, smart aleck, and he's really the star of the show. He plays the part so well, and apparently he asked to be able to play in a part in this because he wanted to do a Western at the time or something. But anyway, his character is supposed to have been a former partner of Henry's dad. And so a lot of it is to do with Samuel Jackson's character manipulating everyone around him. And because of what he's doing, it keeps the whole thing moving along, and it's good. There's a big shootout at the end for you. where everyone kind of can't control themselves, and it's you know, it's a it, it's actually quite a nicely done Western, I think. It's not brilliant. It's you know, it's fine though. It feels a bit like Pierce Brosnan is not really trying very hard, doesn't need to try very hard. But it's a half decent Western with a half decent plot about how they. Oh, I forgot to mention. You know, Samuel L. Jackson's character reckons there's gold buried somewhere. He reckons that Henry's dad had buried gold in the town somewhere. So that's the subplot going on, and then they're all kind of dancing around that. And then there's also this Native American girl that half the town are trying to lynch. It's got all the elements of a really good Western, and it does play out quite well. I did feel at times though it felt a bit like a made for TV film and not a kind of Hollywood blockbuster. But apparently there's a reason behind that, because when they filmed this there was some strike going on or something, and they lost some access to scenery or whatever, so there is a backdrop to that. But the scenes inside the saloon, particularly inside the houses, they were really well. The sets on that were really well done. So yeah, it was okay, good enough Western. Not something I'd watch again, but it was solid entertainment, and just an hour and a half. And I really enjoyed Samuel L. Jackson in it above everything else. It was quite good, and a nice ending and very satisfying. Do you know that one?
I do, yes. I haven't seen it yet. It's on my watch list, but it's a good pairing, and I'd like to get around to that at some stage. Yeah, sounds good.
Cool. Right. Okay. What's your first one? I mean, your only one.
Well, I went back in time to 1986 to watch a movie that I haven't seen since I was a kid, and I remember thinking it was a bit duff back then, and I wanted to see if I could reappreciate it, and I watched it with my son because it's quite tame. It's got a wee bit of bawdiness here and there, but it's one of John Candy's outings from 1986. It's Armed and Dangerous. Now, I remember this. I think I bought it on video and watched it and then looked it up in my review books, and I couldn't find a good review of it anywhere. But I remember quite liking it, but I think seeing all the negative reviews kind of tainted it in my mind. And I thought, no, this is a bad movie. Nobody likes this movie, so I'm going to stop liking it. So I stopped liking it up until I picked it up on... I got it on Blu-ray, actually. Yeah. I thought it was released on 4K, but no, it's just a Blu-ray. No, in fact, it's a DVD. I tell a lie. I've got a DVD of it with Cops and Robertsons with Chevy Chase and Jack Palance. But this has John Candy playing a cop who gets framed and kicked out of the police force and becomes a security guard in a small company which has Meg Ryan and her father Ken McMillan running it, and he makes friends with Eugene Levy from Schitt's Creek, and the two of them become a team who discover a bit of corruption inside the security company with Brian James and Jonathan Banks. You know Jonathan Banks, Mike from Breaking Bad. The two of them are nasty people and Robert Loggia as well. Sorry, I should mention him too. The three of them have a terrible racket going on with the security company. But it struck me as a bit strange, because whilst on the one hand it's a very typical 80s comedy, on the other hand, it's actually got quite a high content of action. And for John Candy to be the sort of almost the main action star in it. And I started feeling that, you know, if they had have got rid of some of the laughs and made this a wee bit more serious, it would have been a much more interesting film, with John Candy running around with a gun, punching out the villains and riding his motorcycle and things like that. And I quite liked it for that. You know, there's chases and punch-ups and shootouts and stuff throughout the film. And I'd say the action content is more than the likes of, say, Police Academy or any Tom Hanks film. You know, generally in the 80s, they like to slap on a bit of a sort of exciting climax to a comedy to give you a bit more bang for your buck. You know, Police Academy always had the third act action stunt extravaganza. And this kind of has it the whole way through with chases and action sequences and John Candy being less of a dope and more of a cocky, swaggery, kind of cool, good guy. And it was a bit strange. And I started to appreciate it a great deal more because of that role. And Eugene Levy, I don't think, got that many lead roles back in the 80s. And he's much better than people give him credit for back in the 80s. I think he's largely forgotten. Robert Loggia dials it up to 11. And Brian James and Jonathan Banks are a wee bit underused. I think they're heavies who walk around in balaclavas and take people out. And Steve Railsback has a fun little cameo as the cowboy, and he gets on well with John Candy, and they're cool. Larry Hankin, who's also for Breaking Bad as well, he's in there too, playing a particularly dippy cop too. And Judy Landers has a fun little moment too. And I honestly really quite enjoyed it. The comedy is very, very 1980s. And actually, to be entirely honest, I recognized a few of the sets from TJ Hooker, particularly the gun range that they were at is used in TJ Hooker a few times. But I was reading into the film because I've got a few things in various books about this. And I noticed that this was originally going to be John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. And I couldn't quite work out which way I would have them play it. You know, would Belushi do the Candy role and Aykroyd do the Levy role? But I can see them doing it the other way around as well. And that was kind of odd as well. And Tegan Clive is in there. I forgot to mention her. I always like to mention her because she's pretty awesome. She's a big, muscly woman who appeared in a bunch of 80s movies, all of which I love, Interzone and Alienator being included. This just worked. I really wanted a wee bit of an 80s comedy scratching, and this worked for me. I've had a look at some of the reviews, and they're still all pretty awful, but, you know, I've slated so many movies and TV shows in this show so far. I think it's quite amazing that, you know, I really enjoyed Armed and Dangerous. John Candy himself has said that it was a terrible film. He was not happy with it at all. And I'm thinking that perhaps he wanted to be a wee bit more serious in this film. And that's what it comes across as. But they decided, no, this is a John Candy film. We're going to fill it full of comedy. But it's 10 times funnier than Meet the Fockers, that's for sure. And I reckon people should maybe check it out again just as a wee bit of a forgotten 80s chunk of comedy. Have you seen it?
No, and I don't think I will either. No. I was watching the trailer run through there, and I could just see that I can see this is exactly your kind of film with all the 1980s big women's hair, and just it's so 1980s.
Oh, okay.
I just looked at a picture of Jonathan Banks in his role in this film, and he was, if you hadn't have told me about that, I would not have recognised him. He is unrecognisable. He is so young, unbelievable. In Breaking Bad, he must have, I don't know how old he is or how he was when he was doing Breaking Bad, but now that I know who he is, I can see who he is, but wow, that is such a big change.
You haven't seen Beverly Hills Cop in a while, then?
I don't understand the reference to that.
Because he's in that. It's one of his most popular roles.
I haven't seen Beverly Hills Cops ever. Because, again, it's one of those American TV shows that I just have got no interest in, I'm afraid. And I know that you have, and that's fine. Okay. Sorry?
Nothing. Yep, that's grand.
Yeah. So, yeah. We all have our interests stuff, don't we? And that's not one of mine, as you know. Yeah, I quite like so, Meg Ryan.
Yeah, John she's Candy. Beautiful and quirky here. It's one of those films that really put me on to her when I was a kid.
Yeah. Wasn't John Candy in Planes, Trains and Automobiles? He was, wasn't he? Yeah. I did like that. You see, there are some exceptions to my self-written rules about 1980s stuff. Planes, Trains and Automobiles, I thought was really funny. And John Candy was good. So, fine. Good.
Well, yeah, it's actually written by James Keach, who is Stacey Keach's younger brother, and Harold Ramis, who was Egon Spengler in Ghostbusters, a film that I'm sure you hate.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, yeah, okay. And he wrote Groundhog Day, another film I'm sure you hate, and
Oh,
Stripes.
yeah. No, I like Groundhog Day.
Okay.
You see the inconsistency.
Yeah, if you've seen it, you probably like it. Right,
Yeah, I
gotcha.
did. Groundhog Day, I thought, was just great. So I don't know what the formula is with me, because some things which you might write me off from like that, then
Yeah, you know,
anyway,
gotcha.
right. I'm going to come back to my last one when we do the final curtain, because it's very relevant to that. So let's head now into coming soon and our picks.
All right. We'll start with you.
Oh yeah, Practical Magic 2. I might regret this. An American comedy, as per the previous conversation, but I'm going with the great cast here. Practical Magic 2. I've not seen Practical Magic 1. But apparently, it's about a multi-generational family of witches cursed to be loveless for centuries, attempts to break the spell by confronting dark secrets and sacrificing for each other. It's starring Sandra Bullock, Nicole Kidman, Stockard Channing, Maisie Williams, and Diane Wast, who's one of Woody Allen's ladies. And I would not probably have given this a second look, except for that cast. And you probably won't like it because they're all female. But it really does look like it's well made, and it looks like it's been well produced. And the trailer makes it look like it just might have something to it. And I'm willing to be proved wrong, and it might be complete rubbish and fit for the bin. Fit for the flop of the fortnight, but from what I see of it so far, carried by that cast, I think it might be all right. I do like Sandra Bullock, very much indeed as an actress. What did you think?
I hated the first one. I do like Sandra Bullock, I'll give you that. She's very funny. She makes a lot of good American comedies that you would hate. Nicole Kidman, yes, I'll get Stockard Channing, yes, okay, and Diane Wise. Yeah, I like most of the things about it. I just I don't know if I can hack it because I was forced to watch the first one at gunpoint, and I begged them to shoot me. And they didn't, the bastards.
Yes. Was the first one the one where they shot one of the ladies got a hole through their stomach? Was that something else?
Oh, that's
Goldie
Death Becomes
Hawn.
Her.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, okay, that's what I was thinking of. So no, I haven't seen it. And I've just realised that on our list here, I've completely forgotten to watch the trailer of your first pick. I'm really sorry.
Oh, right, okay. And it's the one that I thought you would probably like the most, which
Whoops.
means you'll probably hate it. Whale Fall is kind of an interesting I'm going to actually say biblical, to be honest, because it happens in the Bible. It's the story of Jonah, kind of. No, it's about a guy who gets swallowed by a whale. A scuba diver who's looking for his father's remains is swallowed by an 80-foot, 60-ton sperm whale and has just 1 hour to get out before he runs out of oxygen. And it's utterly preposterous how this comes about. Josh Brolin plays his father, and Austin Abrahams plays the guy who gets eaten. Elizabeth Shue's in there as well, just for good measure. And it actually looks fairly decent. If it wasn't for the fact that I think this was in the news a couple of years ago, where a guy got swallowed up by a whale off the South American coast, and he was in there for a while, and he eventually got barfed up on the beach and had extreme burns because the whale's stomach acids had burnt his skin quite badly. So I think he was in a bit of a state whenever he got out. But this film seems to decide to take the cinematic side and have him be tossed around inside and have to do battle with a squid and things inside. It just looks bonkers. And I think I kind of fancy it. Ted?
As I say, I've not seen the trailer, so I can't really comment. But while you've been talking, I have been watching it rolling on IMDb. And it does, I think I agree with you, it just does look a bit absurd and nonsense. And of course, as you say, all the religious people are going to be all over this, which will make it even more annoying for me. I don't want to watch this, thank you.
Or no, I think it'll make it even funnier because they're going to look for religious parables or whatever inside of this movie and not find them, because it's very, very much a popcorn flick about a guy gets eaten by a whale.
Right, so, next up is Jenna Ortega, the pint-sized little beauty. She's playing a kind of Gemma Chan humans robot girl in this film called Clara and the Sun, and it's coming to cinemas in October. I might regret this one too, I said in my notes here, but perhaps Jenna will save it for me. So she's a robot girl, an android designed to prevent loneliness, and she tries to save a heartbroken family of humans from themselves. It's got Amy Adams in it as well, and it's been directed by that person who I can never pronounce the name of. I'll come back to that. The news is, though, when I watched the trailer for a second time, I'm not sure that I can get past this at all. It looks like a lot of nonsense to me. Jenna Ortega being in there or not. And so, but I'm sure that American teen and family-based audience will lap it up and think it's great. So we'll see. What did you reckon?
I think Taika Waititi can be quite hit or miss. Sometimes he's funny, sometimes he's not. Like the Time Bandits, no, that was an atrocity. Jojo the Rabbit was rather good. What We Do in the Shadows, and he did, was it Guardians of the Galaxy or something like that? I can't remember. But one of those big superhero-y type films. I can take him or leave him, to be honest, but I'll certainly give this a go. It does look interesting enough, and I do like my dystopian sci-fi, so yeah, why not?
Okay. Yep.
Or not.
We'll see. I could be swung either way.
Right. So, this one is entirely here to piss Ted off. This is Golden Axe, the TV show. Because I know Ted is such a big lover of the Golden Axe franchise. Back in the 1980s, I'm sure he was pumping coins into arcade machines up and down the country. This is a reimagining of the TV or the classic computer game to make it up and popular with the kids, because it's got the comedies in it too. It's arriving on Paramount Plus on September 16th. And I honestly don't know how I feel about this. It's a part of me is going, leave my beloved Golden Axe alone. But I did chuckle a couple of times at the meta comedy that they've thrown in here that Ted just loves. Ted, you're obviously first in the queue for this type of thing.
I didn't read your brief properly, to be honest. I didn't realize it was tied up with a Sega game franchise thingy, and so I just went straight into it, and then it lasted about 45 seconds. I think, good grief, what on earth is this about? And you're quite right, it's not for me, but I'm sure it will be for other people.
Yes, I believe it is for other people as well. You know, Paramount don't just make stuff for you. Mm-hmm. Next up.
Oh, sorry, it's me. And it is. Oh, this is another. I don't know. Shaun the Sheep, which is on the back of the what's it, park animation thingies.
Everyone.
That's the one. The Beast of Mossy Bottom, which is another one. It's coming to cinemas in September, and I just wonder how many of these they can make before it's all very clever, this stop motion animation. And it was when Wallace and Gromit were out first. It was We were all over it, and the BBC were all over it. It was always everywhere. But I think it's kind of becoming a bit samey now. They've got the Halloween in here. They're going to release it just for Halloween, well, a month before Halloween. So they've kind of got a topical twist going on in this particular one. And I'm no doubt at all that young kids will really love it, as they were used to back in the day when they first came out, and kids around us did. This one is. Yeah, it's about a clumsy farmer, the usual thing, ruining the pumpkin patch for Halloween. Shaun the Sheep tries to fix it with science experiments, but things go wrong when a wild beast appears in the woods. You can just imagine, can't you? And as I say, it might be absolutely fine, but I just wonder how much mileage they can get out of this whole thing. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm actually trying to work out is this a franchise of films, Shaun the Sheep? I remember the first movie, and then TV shows and things like that, but I didn't realize that they made, a sequel movie.
Yeah, there's been a few of them, I think, and there was a TV show as well.
Yeah.
So there was a TV. Yeah, I can't remember now, but yes, they had. There is a few of them out.
I watched the original movie and I thought it was terrific. And Aardman's Curse of the Were-Rabbit was terrific. So I have absolutely no bones against giving this a go as well, because I do find them very chucklesome. But it's coming out without very much in the way of a fanfare, so it makes me a bit concerned that perhaps this is just a TV special that they're pushing out in cinemas to get a wee bit of a limited run. And then it'll be on Christmas Day or something like that.
Well, it's supposed to be Halloween.
I know, but it'll arrive on Christmas Day for families to watch on BBC One after the Queen's speech. That's really
She's dead.
King's speech then. Thought you didn't watch the news.
I don't. But you'd be hard pushed to not know that the Queen was dead.
Well, yeah, we're in Northern Ireland. We don't know. We
Right,
don't know.
okay, what's next? Get us away from this Shaun the Sheep rubbish.
All right, the last one here is something that I thought looked a wee bit intriguing. It actually comes out in a couple of days' time, and I'm a bit interested into what it is, because it's a teaser for a film called Buddy, and it's about a brave girl and her friends who must escape a kid's television show. But if you watch it, the teaser is a wee bit creepy enough to make you go, oh, what's happening there? It's got Kristen Milinotti, who we loved in Palm Springs and
Yay,
a few other
Fargo.
things. Fargo, yes. And Topher Grace is there as well. And Keegan-Michael Key, Patton Oswalt. It has a great cast. I really like the cast. And I just think that this looks to be something quite sinister and scary. And I don't even know. I think it's a movie as opposed to, yeah, it's R35, so it's a movie. And it's directed by Casper Kelly. But that wee teaser is just beautifully creepy. What did you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. The teaser was a real tease. And when you think it's kind of finished and you think it's a real short teaser, it suddenly opens up again with this kind of snowy, fuzzy TV, and then the characters behaving very sinister-like and strangely around the camera that's shooting them. And then Kristen Milioti turns up in the middle of this, and she can do no wrong as far as I'm concerned. So I'm going to watch this just to see her. But Yeah, it's a bit of a mystery, isn't it? And given that it's due out any minute now, it's surprising that they have not put a proper trailer out. But then maybe that's the point. They don't want people to know about it.
Yeah, it's a peculiar one because you're also wondering what the suggestion is. You know, is it a murdery thing or a pedophile-y thing or, you know, abducting kids? Yeah.
Very interesting. So, yeah, good pick that one. I'm looking forward to it enormously.
Aye.
And let's go to find the final curtain and see. There's quite a few in today, isn't there? Lead us
Yeah.
away.
Well, we'll start with Screaming Mad George. We lost Screaming Mad George recently, who is very well known as a practical effects artist. And he directed the movie The Guyver with Mark Hamill. Didn't do the sequel, but you know, it wasn't that great. But he did the practical effects for many great horror films, like I think he did a was two of the Reanimator movies. He did Curse 2 about the guy's arm turned into a snake. That was crass. Society, which is, if anyone's seen that, they'll know the makeup effects in that is insane. Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and 4, 3 being one of the best of the series. Big Trouble in Little China, Predator, Hide and Go Shriek, Arena, The Abyss. And Children of the Corn 3, which wasn't that great, but and he also did Space Truckers. I'll throw that in because it was shot here. But yes, he unfortunately passed away. But what a creative guy, incredibly creative guy. Are you aware of any of those films that I've said or his creations?
I know The Abyss. I'm just looking. So he did the kind of artistic stuff on The Abyss. He didn't direct it. No, that
No, it
was,
was James Cameron.
So he's got one directorial, which is The Guyver, isn't he? But yeah, I've definitely seen The Abyss, and I thought that was really well done and really engaging. I've seen Predator, the original one, and again, you can see the artistic stuff in there. But the backstory, you've linked to the Wikipedia page in this thing, and he's a strange looking guy, isn't he? And he, well, he was a strange looking guy. But if you read some of his background about why he changed his name to Screaming Mad George and where he comes from in Japan and his whole career, and he used to be a punk rock musician in the 70s with a band
Yeah.
called The Mad. And yeah, the whole background for him, I'd never heard of him, but reading that, I think that's really interesting and very sad that someone with such a clear talent, artistically certainly, has gone.
Yeah. Absolutely incredible career and life. And he passed away quite early on. He was what, 70, I think. 1956. This is 2026. Yeah, we'll go with 70. Yeah, and he still looked rather young. Yeah. Next up, and I don't think anyone could have avoided this news, is that Hayden Panettiere has passed away, who was in the TV series Heroes, well known for that. And she was also in one of the Scream movies, and was a leading actress in many a movie since then. There was a PlayStation game that she led in that was a huge deal a number of years ago, actually 10 years ago, looking at it, was in 2015, called Until Dawn. And she, oh no, she was in two Scream films, 4 and 6. And she just had a film released the other day called Sleepwalker. That looks fairly interesting as well. A Breed Apart was one that I picked up on DVD, but I haven't actually got around to watching yet. About doggies that like to go around killing people. Sounds great. Yes, there's a whole lot of stuff going around about her passing, and connections with various different people. And it's possible that people are saying that she might have actually been taken out as opposed to passing away from whatever it is, but they haven't ruled on what it is that she has passed away from. But her biography is there, and it has some suggestions about things that happened in her life whenever she was younger and more Less able to say no to certain people in industries. So are you aware of Hayden?
I didn't know her name until it was announced, but then when I saw her, when I started to look at the name and associate her, I came up with some links. Amber Alert, I saw quite recently, which is a film about this woman, her, in this car where they're trying to rescue this child that's been abducted. And that was very good. She did really well in that. And then I suddenly realized that, yes, Ally McBeal. She was Maddie, who was Ally McBeal's adopted daughter in the show for about two series. Later on in the whole thing, it might have only been one series. And she was a very pretty girl back then. And it is really sad. Apparently she wrote this book or memoir, This Is Me, A Reckoning, in which she wrote about depression, addiction, recovery, domestic abuse and loads of other stuff. It'd be quite interesting to read that if it's out there and available. But it sounds like she had a bit of a tough life and she was thrown into kind of childhood fame early. And as we know, kids can come a cropper with that sort of thing, but very sad. And 36 she was, in case you didn't say that.
Yeah, it was very sad. Next up is another name that we'd actually missed at the time that she passed away, which is on August 9th, but Cheryl Hall. Ted, I'll let you take the lead on this.
Yeah, most famously known, I think, for Citizen Smith, where she plays...
Power to the people.
Yeah, power to the people. Tooting Popular People's Front. No, that's the wrong one. that's a mix-up with Monty Python. So she has been... She's been in an awful lot of 1970s TV, but she's one of these people that... who has kind of dipped in and out, and you see her popping up on this, that and the other. Like for one episode she was in On the Buses, the epidemic in 1971. She played a Clippy in that. She played Rodney Bewes's on-screen girlfriend in Dear Mother, Love Albert, and she was in a few Doctor Who episodes, I think. She was even in Bless His House. She played Sid Abbott's secretary, probably one or two episodes. She did Sykes. She worked with David Jason in Lucky Fella. She was in some films as well, not very many films, but a few. No Sex Please Were British, which we've spoken about before on the show.
That was the two Ronnies, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's a whole plethora of comic stars from the 70s in No Sex Please Were British, as there is in The Magnificent Seven Deadly Sins, which is the one I wanted to leap back to just make my main... the main feature, because she had passed away, I decided to have a look at this, and I'm sure you probably have seen this and know it, but it's a really good, fun British camp romp kind of film. There's loads of stars in it. I'll give you a list: Spike Milligan, Bruce Forsyth, Joan Sims, June Whitfield, Leslie Phillips, Marty Feldman, Ronnie Barker, the reference here is that there was a quick appearance in one of the sections of The Magnificent Seven Deadly Sins for Cheryl Hall to be in it. And she, to be honest, she wasn't in it very much. But then this is a sketch based film, and it's really, really funny, and it's very, very dated. It feels very much like a kind of Carry On film. But I also wanted to just mention in my thoughts on it that there is one section in it which I think stands out as better quality than some of the other ones, which is the lust segment, and it's written by Galton and Simpson, and it features Harry H. Cormitt of kind of Steptoe fame, And he plays this very, very funny, moving performance as this man in this tube station looking for love, being stood up, and ends up talking to this girl in a phone box next to him. I won't give you the outcome of the story, but he plays that so well, and it's very, very moving. And it's quite different to the other ones that are in the Seven Deadly Sins film for 1971. But going back to her, Cheryl Hall, yeah, she was in one of those, and that's why I just wanted to mention it, she had been in there. There was also one other film that I picked up on, which was Three for All, which I haven't seen and I'm not familiar with, but yeah, somebody who's done loads and loads of 1970s TV, she was certainly a face in Citizen Smith. Apparently she dipped out of Citizen Smith. She did two series of it, and then she got fed up with being the kind of dumb blonde character, so she said, I'm not doing anymore, and cleared off. And I've written a tribute to Cheryl Hall in my blog, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes, because I kind of do a bit of a deep dive into some of the background and some of the kind of sub stories of what I've just been talking about. So yeah, very sad. And you're right, we missed it on the last show, so sorry about that, but we're doing it now.
Yeah. Well, we've got two more, and they were, well, late additions. They came through today. The first is Dolly Parton, the country and western singer who was a bit of an angel to many. She made a number of films in the 80s and 90s and on after that, but I don't think she was quite into the movie making back then, or more now. She was in 9 to 5 with, was it Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, which is a film that I've seen once, but it just wasn't my bag. Rhinestone with Sylvester Stallone. The Blue Valley Songbird. And Unlikely Angel. There was one called Frank McCluskey's CI with Randy Quaid. And then there was the one I know her best from, Straight Talk with James Woods. And then The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, which I've seen it twice. It took me a while to get around to it because it was a Burt Reynolds film that I just wasn't too fussed on. But I think she's best known for her on stage persona, where she was just a magical lady who always had a very positive outlook on life, and I can't imagine too many people disliked her in any way. I remember there was a metal gig that she went to. She spoke about how she was on stage talking to all these heavy metalers, and they were all completely entranced by her and inspired by her, which is, you know, it was not her typical audience, but she still won them over anyway. I think she's just one of those ladies that everybody thought, yeah, she's great. Yeah, lovely. Any takeaway from Dolly Parton?
I wasn't really aware of her being an actor, and when this news broke, I just thought she was a singer, a country and western singer, and I don't like country and western music, so she was not on my radar at all. I think the thing that needs to be said about her more so is that the work she's done for disadvantaged children and charities, as well as being just a figure on particularly American TV a lot. She was in tons and tons of TV shows and did loads of music videos, and just you know, as you say, it's difficult to imagine that anyone would not like her at all. And she was, sounds like she was a very nice lady and did lots of good things for people, lived a good life and did lots of stuff.
I did, I forgot one particular movie that she was in that was a biggie called Steel Magnolias. This is not a biggie to me, but my wife loves it. She's got a copy of it on DVD and keeps it down in the living room just in case, next to Mystic Pizza, which I don't believe she's in, but she could be. I don't know. But yes, I fancy watching Straight Talk again because I fancy a wee bit of James Woods. It's been a while.
I did see 9 to 5, but the same as you, it just wasn't my kind of thing. So I just, I think I only watched half of it, to be honest. But anyway, very sad. She was 80.
Yeah. And I also want to throw in that Best Little Whorehouse in Texas had that song, "And I Will Always Love You," but she sang it a wee bit better than me.
Okay.
It was also in The Bodyguard. I think The Bodyguard
Yeah,
made it
it was
really
Whitney Houston.
famous, but Dolly did it first, and she
Oh,
did
did
it in
she?
that movie first.
Oh, right.
And then it was snaffled, stolen, because she sings it to Burt Reynolds, and it's a very
Yeah.
dramatic moment. Lastly, we have, and this is a really heartfelt one, is Tim Curry, an actor who I have adored for years. Back in the 80s, I got really into his filmography and started watching everything I possibly could, until it became impossible to watch everything he was in because he was in everything. He was one of those character actors. I remember there being an interview with someone who was talking about the Rocky Horror Picture Show and Tim Curry's career after that, because they found him quite difficult to cast because he's not your typical leading man, and they were looking for projects that were kind of quirky and interesting for his type of character that he would play, his type of his acting, or his method. There weren't too many that lent to it, so he would end up being really colorful character actors, or characters in bigger films. Obviously, Rocky Horror Picture Show is one of those huge movies, and everybody knows him from that because he's one of the most iconic characters in history. But he followed that up with a little film called Times Square, that I was lucky enough to track down whenever I was quite young. And I don't remember too much about it, but I was a wee bit put off by it because it wasn't Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is what I was looking for. And there was one called Blue Money as well, that was a wee comedy set around London, where he's a con man. But then Legend was one that he became huge name from, opposite Tom Cruise, where he played basically Satan, but the darkness. And he followed that up with Clue. And Clue is the best comedy I think ever made. It's possible that some people have not seen this and agree with that, because they're idiots. But yes, Clue is the greatest comedy of all time. And he plays Wadsworth, the butler who buttles. And he followed that up with Pass the Ammo, and he was in the Wise Guy TV series, and he was opposite Sam Neill in Hunt for October, and he played Pennywise in the original TV miniseries of It, which is a bit tacky now. It's difficult to go back and revisit that. I did after watching the movie because I felt that the movie wasn't that great, and then I watched the TV show and I went, "Oh, that's even worse." And then he was off at Sylvester Stallone in Oscar, and Passed Away was a Bob Hoskins comedy, which I felt that he was a bit underused in. I was a bit annoyed that he wasn't in it as much as I had hoped he would be. Home Alone 2 is one of the more famous films that he's known for, where he plays the concierge. He's constantly trying to capture Macaulay Culkin's kid, who is on his own in the hotel. Loaded Weapon 1, he's very funny as Wilderness Girls, where he plays one of the little cookie selling wilderness girls, but he's actually a henchman for William Shatner's overarching villain. He was in an episode of Tales from the Crypt, and The Three Musketeers as Cardinal Richelieu, The Shadow as Farley Claymore, and he gets to run around with a Tommy gun, blasting things. I love The Shadow. The Shadow was a great movie. He was in a series of video games as well called Gabriel Knight, which was a point-and-click adventure game. He was also in Wing Commander, the computer game, and Command and Conquer Red Alert, which he was just hilarious in. So one of the best roles you could see him in, and he is just hamming it up. If you get a chance, go onto YouTube and watch some of his scenes, because he's so funny in that. He's just taking the piss. Congo, which isn't a great film, but he's particularly good in it. It was his first outing with Bruce Campbell, because he was in a couple of other Bruce Campbell movies as well. He played Long John Silver in The Muppet Treasure Island. He was in the miniseries of Titanic, actually. Not the big movie, but the miniseries. He was in McHale's Navy, the movie, with Bruce Campbell. Casper, and a whole rake of other films that... he's so well known for. Charlie's Angels was there as well. Ted, you're very aware of Tim Curry, I'm guessing.
You guess wrong. I'm really sorry, but I'm aware of his name, and I think if I was pushed, I would probably might have been able to associate his name with Rocky Horror Picture Show. Not that I've seen that, but all of the things that you've just said about comedy this, comedy that, American comedies, is all the things that are just off my radar, I'm afraid. I just looked at Congo. I have seen Congo, and I've just looked at his character, the picture of his character in Congo, and I watched that quite recently because we spoke about it on the show. And I do remember his face in there, and I think at the time I said he looks a bit like Alan Parsons there. And I do, yes, I recognise him and his face from Congo. But all the other stuff, The Hunt from Red October, I watched that, but I couldn't place him in that. Sorry, he's just not on my radar, Gareth. But I'm glad that you're a big fan.
Well, over the last couple of years, he hasn't had much of a profile either, because he did suffer a stroke back in, it was about 2015 or 2016, which was quite debilitating for him, but it didn't slow him down. He was still working. He was still appearing, because fans loved him for playing Frankenfurter and Rocky Horror. He would still attend events, and people would just, you know, go mad for him, because he was such an icon. He really was, and it's really sad that he's passed away. I've loved Tim Curry for so long, given his body of work, you know, on IMDb credits him with over 243 different projects, you know, of different types, whether it be video games, major movies, and TV shows and things like that, and cartoons and stuff. He would do a lot of voices for cartoon characters as well. So he's a whole institution in himself. And I never actually worked out where he was from. I think he was British. He was Cheshire, England. So he was born around the corner from you, Ted.
Yeah, right. Or where I live now. Yeah. Very sad. But as I say, sorry, a lot of these people that seem to come into the final curtain, I don't know very well, but I'm glad that you do, and I'm glad you appreciated him, and you could talk very authoritatively about all the stuff you like about him. So well done. Okay, so we're done now. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time, as always. GarethMiles.com is where you'll find Gareth. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find me. ProjectorRoom.co.uk is our website. And Podhub UK, you can head to if you get lost with anything. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts and all of our lovely MeWe groups. Let us know what you've been watching, and we'll bring the highlights of those two shows going forward. That's it, really. We'll hopefully you can join us again in 2 weeks' time when we once again head for the projector room.